Welcome to the Hoops Hype Podcast. My name is Alex Kennedy. Today I'm joined by Yaron Weitzman, a national NBA writer for Bleacher Report, who just wrote his first book. The book is called Tanking to the Top, The Philadelphia 76ers and the Most Audacious Process in the History of Professional Sports. It's an incredible read and it's available now. Check out the description of this episode for a link to order the book. Yaron, thanks for joining me. How are you?
I'm as good as any of us can be while, you know, we're healthy and, you know, stuck in a two-bedroom apartment with my wife and two kids in New York City. But other than that, I am great.
Other than that, yeah, things are kind of crazy right now, obviously. But I will say this is a good time to have a book come out because everyone's at home and looking for something to do. This was obviously a great way for me to pass some time. I really enjoyed reading the book. And so, I mean, have you been getting that feedback from a lot of people that this is a way for them to kind of pass the time when there's nothing else to do?
Yeah, no, that I have, for sure. Yes. I mean, listen, some people like they're the other group. So, and I'm in that other group again. If you have kids, then you're kind of like, I'm angry at all these people who say they're bored and searching for ways to fill their time. Like, I would love to have a moment where I'm bored, but no, there's a group that I have heard that. And, you know, so I guess I'd like to think, I know I'm certainly looking for, an occasional distraction from all of the, craziness. So I'm hope that this can maybe provide that to some people.
Yeah, it's a great way to escape. This is your first book, so I'm curious how it came together. When did you decide that you wanted to write a book, and how did you come up with the specific book idea?
Yeah, I always feel like my answer is a disappointment because it's not like I had some artistic calling. I mean, I always wanted to write a book, a sports book, and then I was around the team. So my quote-unquote day job is a national NBA writer for Bleacher Report, and I say the national part not to make myself sound more important because I'm not, but just the idea of what my job is. My job is to find stories that a national audience would find interesting, and being based in New York, that New York is not providing that with the Knicks or Nets, right? So I had to leave pretty regularly. So I started going down to Philadelphia around 2017, kind of could tell that they were on the rise, Embiid, Simmons, a lot of personalities, a lot of interesting stuff going on there. And then I was around the team that playoffs, I guess that was the year they lost to Boston. And one day on the train back, I just kind of remember thinking, oh, I feel like this could be a good book idea. So again, it wasn't like I had some drawing, like, oh, I have a major story I want to tell. And the funny part in hindsight is like I sort of pitched this book as a Moneyball but basketball thing. And that's like if you look at my proposal, right, that's what it looks like. And it did not turn out as that. And I'm happy about that. It's good to learn new things and be surprised through the reporting process. But it ended up being more about, like, I think the backroom stuff. And I kind of like describe it as a book of, I like to think that's a book about how the NBA works, right? How it actually works behind the scenes and what all the stuff that happens that leads to the product we see. So it ended up being different, but I'm happy.
Well, that's why, you know, I think I was so drawn to it, and I think our Hoops Hype readers will love it because we try to do a lot of the behind the scenes type articles and podcasts. You know, I think a lot of the Hoops Hype readers and listeners are diehard fans that want even more in-depth stuff, and they want to know what happens in the rooms and in the draft and on draft night, the trade deadline, and that this book is just full of those kind of stories and that kind of information. So I think our readers will love this. But you mentioned, you know, in the book, you kind of joke too that you naively thought you were writing an NBA version of Moneyball, but then things changed, as you just mentioned. How different is the actual book from the one that you envisioned? And how much of that was because Sam Hinkie and others in the Sixers organization didn't participate?
That's a good question. So very different, right? And to answer your first question, I thought it'd be more simple, more about the analytics and stuff like that. And like the strategy of tanking, which I'm happy it is, because I think those stories kind of get old a little bit, the idea of praising XGM. We see this in lots of sports for, being this super smart guy. And I don't know, a lot of it's luck. There's a lot more goes into it. I think we overblow that a lot. Moneyball accepted. Moneyball being the exception. In terms of not being able to talk to Sam Hinkie, really, or the Sixers, did that lead to it? That's good. I mean, I guess so, right? Probably. And I kind of early on accepted it as a challenge, and like you have to go digging in other places. And it probably made the book better, honestly, that I didn't get to talk to those guys, or at least, you know, or at least at the beginning that I didn't get to talk to them. Maybe if at the end that's the ideal, is you kind of come back to them at the end. If in the beginning, like Embiid and Hinkie and Brett Brown and Josh Harris and these guys are all giving me 4-hour, 5-hour sit-down interviews, I'd like to think I go call former players, former manager, you know, or like, you know, former scouts or all these, make these extra calls. But in the end, you probably, it's just hard to when you have like deadlines looming. But it's those extra calls that sort of give you a different perspective. And I think they give you a lot of good nuggets. Like, I had one great story from Jason Richardson's manager, former manager, which, again, why would I call that person, right? But telling me a story about how after Sam Hinkie had traded Jrue Holiday in 2013, I think it was, the draft, and that kind of signaled the rebuild was happening. And Jason Richardson and his manager went to meet Hinkie in his office to find out sort of what the role was for Jason Richardson as a veteran going forward. And Hinkie says, I need the end of the talk. At the end, Hinkie asks for restaurant recommendations. They give him one, and he goes, I'm going to need go out the back door because everybody in the city is going to hate me. So little anecdotes like that are great, right? And I think telling. And I also like to think that this story, you know, in the end, it kind of came in the book. Not that we've heard a lot from Embiid and from Brett Brown over the years and from these other guys. And I think it served readers and basketball fans more to hear. Not that we don't necessarily hear from them, but to get different perspectives and views on these people.
Yeah, and I think that's why there's a lot of new stories, because we haven't heard their take on these things. I've enjoyed doing that in this podcast. We've had Jason Richardson and Rashawn Holmes and other guests like that on the podcast, and we've talked about those Trust the Process years, and it's so interesting to kind of get their perspective on it. So this book is full of that. And, you know, we talked about how Sam didn't participate. That's kind of who Sam is. I've tried to get him on this podcast, and he just never wants to be in the spotlight or do any kind of interviews. Yep. But then the Sixers also, they weren't very helpful, to the point that a player who you considered close to you backed out of an interview after you guys had already kind of scheduled it and talked about it. Why do you think the Sixers were so resistant and didn't want this story to be told?
Oh, God. I wish I knew, man. That's my short answer. I wish I knew. No, I mean, I think part of it is there are a few things, right? I think part of it is this story. Well, part of the beginning is they didn't know me very well. So that's fine, right? And it's easy to say no at the beginning. And I wasn't surprised they said no at the beginning, right? It's easy to shoot down interviews because it's easier not to do it than it is to do it. I was surprised when it was kind of made clear that, like, this book's happening whether they participate or not. And, you know, it's like the release date is set. You know, all these things are happening. And even that, at no point did somebody call me into an office, and even off the record, right, try to sway me, right, try to play me, for better or worse, right? I'm not saying I would be played, but why not do that? Honestly, I do not know. I do not know. I don't know if it became a control thing at the end, if they thought it would be better, if they thought I wouldn't get anything. I know, like, the idea of the process is sort of this this point in history they're not necessarily proud of, right? Like, they don't promote Sam Hinkie or the idea that they tanked for a few years. I know they don't necessarily like that. Like, Josh Harris had a weird line about it in I think it was last summer league 2018, 2019, maybe 2018, I lose track here, but we pretty much called it a weird science experiment, or like a science experiment, if you look up the exact quote. He referred to the process, which is, again, kind of strange. Team CEO Scott O'Neill was not a fan of Hinkie. I put that in the book. So I'm guessing that's part of it. Though, again, I poke fun, like, they don't like the process, and they don't like talking about it. And yet, you know, they do that. On the other hand, they trademark Trust the Process so they can make money off the saying, right? So it's kind of talking on both sides there. A short answer to answer you, I don't know. I don't understand why at some point nobody says, okay, you know. And I think teams, like, they know who I'm talking to. Maybe not everybody, but I think they get an idea of who I'm talking to and what I'm getting. And why at no point do they try calling me in and say, here's what's all cards on the table. Let's have an off-the-record chat. I do not know.
Right. If the book is happening either way, you'd think you'd want to at least try to shape the narrative and maybe share some stories that put the franchise in a good light or things like that, you know, at the very least. But I just found that interesting. I was wondering, you know, why they were approaching it that way. Maybe it is about credit and control, and, you know, maybe they don't want Sam Hinkie getting all of this credit because he did do a lot of things that kind of set them up in this position and you know, built that foundation. So I don't know. I was just curious. I didn't know if you ever got a reason or anything, but yeah, it is kind of strange. We'll get to more of the topics that are in the book in a second, but I want to ask you just about the process of writing it. I've talked about on this podcast how I would love to write a book, but it's so intimidating and daunting. What was the process for you like when you sat down and actually started writing, and how different was it than writing an article?
Very, right? It was weird. So the way I kind of did it, and like at first it was daunting. It even took me like a month or two to figure out how I wanted to organize my notes. Like, I spent money on this thing called Scrivener, which is like this tool that like historians and researchers and book writers use. It's like to organize things, and that didn't work for me. And I ended up going with Google Docs, and it's spreadsheets, and just you figure out how you want to dump your notes. It sounds silly, but like that takes a while, right? Because you kind of have to figure out how to organize and process all that stuff. The way I kind of broke it up is I said I was going to report for, I had about 12, 13 months to do it. So I figured I would report for half and then write for half. So I started writing about January. The thing is, reporting doesn't stop, right? Whether it's because of new developments, whether you're in the middle of a chapter and something seems like, oh, I'm missing a scene here, or I could use another detail, or this doesn't make sense. We do make some other calls. Like that happened with me when I was putting together the my Joel Embiid chapter, and you start holding up, you know, going through my notes and reading all the different profiles and Players Tribune pieces he's done. And you start seeing, wait, this says he was discovered at the age of 16. And this says he was discovered at the age of 15. And this says he was playing for 3 months. And this said he played for six. And you start finding little discrepancies in a way that probably no one ever else has, just because who else would print out every, like in this example, who else would go look at every single profile ever written about Joel Embiid at the same time, right, altogether, and start mapping it out? So like little things like that lead to more reporting. So that went on. Then after the Kawhi shot, after the Raptors series, like, so let's say that was May, right? And I handed in my first draft about August. I pretty much went to my office. Like, I have a little office around the corner from my apartment, and I would go there like every night from after my kids went to sleep, from say 7:30 p.m. to midnight, and write, you know. And that's what I probably got, I don't know, let's say 40% of the writing done. So yeah, it was definitely daunting. In terms of reporting, you just like, I would make a list of everyone and, okay, here's everyone I want to talk to. Here's everyone that ever played for the team, worked for the team. Here's anyone who ever worked or played or knew those guys who worked or played for the team. You kind of just build out a network and you develop sources, and some you have to go after. Some are happy to talk. Some become people who you can tell they're not upset when they hear your phone ring, when they see your phone, your name on their phone while it's ringing. And you kind of go from there.
For sure. You do a good job of outlining what led to the Sixers hiring Sam Hinkie and starting this rebuild. That's in the beginning of the book, you know, from Allen Iverson's departure to the awful Andrew Bynum trade to Doug Collins and that regime's refusal to use analytics. It seems like there was a perfect storm that occurred that kind of led to Hinkie getting hired. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, it starts with the ownership. I think this is something I found. I'm not the first to find this, but I don't know if it had been, I don't know if a lot of casual fans kind of follow this knew this, but like ownership, they play a huge role here, which like a kind of duh, okay? But the idea being, these guys came from private equity, and I made sure to write about this in the book a little bit, the idea of what private equity is, right? These are finance guys, and who had made a lot of their money, and this is going to sound familiar, right? The idea of buying a distressed asset, tearing it down, and building it back up. Does that sound like the process, right? So again, the idea that this was something that spoke to them. They come in 2011. And again, as much as people like to beat up on ownership, they did do a lot of smart things. They kind of hung around, I think correctly, early on. They didn't want to shake things up too much because it was a new business. They admitted and they recognized that they didn't know much about it. So they kind of let guys like Doug Collins stay. Also, you know, Doug Collins, if you don't know anything, if you're not an NBA guy and you come in and Doug Collins is at the team, and he's sort of this, you know, larger than life character, NBA legend, or basketball legend, I should say, right? You've heard him on TV, you've watched him, you've seen him coach. He's going to like let you in his office and share stories and things like that. You can get captivated by that. They have the playoff series. They make the Andrew Bynum trade, which it was a good trade. Like, it blew up, and even Josh Harris said this after, right? Our process was good, the results were bad. And I think that was true, right? They realized they had sort of plateaued, figured we need a star, one's available. He's from the area, he's close to us, he would re-sign with us, let's do it. That obviously didn't work out. And as that season was going on, they recognized that the Sixers literally had no analytics department, right? That year they hired this guy, Aaron Barzilai. He was the first Sixers analytics employee. So like there was a staff of one, right? And then after the Bynum year, things blow up and they let, they decide they want to shake things up. They let Collins and some of the other executives kind of come up to New York every week and pitch them on their vision and things like that. But in the end, they end up hiring Hinkie to carry out. And this is, again, the process. Like Hinkie, I always compare, if he's the architect of the process, if you hire an architect to renovate your house, it's not like the architect. He's carrying out your vision, right? So it wasn't like Hinkie came with them with this thing that seemed foreign and had to wow them and convince them. This was along the lines of what they were thinking, and they were sort of on board together in terms of the teardown.
Yeah, and it sounds like that's one of the reasons why Sam was willing to take the job. He wanted to make sure they were on the same page, because this kind of teardown doesn't work unless everyone's on the same page. And I think eventually maybe there was some clashing, but at the time it seemed like everyone was kind of on board, so that's why it seemed like a fit initially. But let's talk about Sam for a second. He has such an interesting story. He was, you touched on this in the book, but he was this president of his high school class 4 years in a row, valedictorian. And then obviously a super smart guy. He started working in sports as an intern for the 49ers and then worked for the Houston Texans before transitioning to the NBA. Can you share some of the interesting stuff that you learned about Hinkie and his background?
Yeah, I mean, I just love the idea that this guy who we all think of as Silicon Valley type is from a small town in Oklahoma and was a jock, right? Basically, I just think that's kind of breaks stereotypes. Yeah, I mean, a couple. One, he's just got tragedy in his background that when he was 10, his older brother committed suicide. And, you know, Hinkie understandably does not like discussing that, which, again, in a way, I sort of feel bad that I write about it and bring it up. I just kind of have to if it's part of his story, even though I wish, you know, you don't feel good about that. I found it interesting that that night he told a story on his podcast. He alluded to it, but it's clear he's talking about the day his brother killed himself, that he found solace in basketball, shooting hoops with a buddy and a buddy's father. And I do think Sam, you know, we think of him as sort of this cold guy, but I do think he believed and maybe still believes in the idea, like the kind of the magical cliche stuff of sports, right? I think he believes in that. He always wanted to be around sports. He just had different views of it. So from that, I found interesting his relationship with the Houston Texans, that he had sort of cold, I don't think it was emails then, I think it was letter, cold written, Charlie Casserly, who was a former GM there, and his resume stood out. And Charlie Casserly had Sam Hinkie doing like real work for the Texans as Sam was in Stanford Business School then. But Hinkie would like a lot of draft prep, kind of looking at, there was this chart. I think Jimmy Johnson is the one who created it, this like draft value chart that a lot of teams work off of, like how many, you know, if I trade a first round pick that's worth 100 points, I need to make sure I get 100 points back in second or third round picks, basically. The math, the numbers are different, but that's the basic idea. And Hinkie had sort of deconstructed it and realized like ways how the chart was made and how maybe it was overvaluing linebackers. I forget, maybe it was based on Pro Bowl nods and nominations, appearances, and he, like, that's a very subjective measure. But if you realize that it's subjective, you can, you know, you can take advantage of that. You can create a marketing efficiency if you recognize how something is made and how a lot of other teams are operating. So I found things like that fascinating, right? And Charlie Casserly loved him. He thought Hinkie was great. He wanted him to keep him. There was just no job for him. So from there, he kind of ended up, you know, he wrote a letter to the Houston Rockets, and that's how we got into basketball. So I found that really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, there's a scenario where Hinkie goes on to become this really excellent NFL GM instead of ever becoming an NBA GM. So I think that part of the story is pretty interesting. What were some of your favorite stories or favorite things that you learned while doing the interviews and research for this book?
A lot. That's a good one. I mean, I enjoyed the thread of Joel Embiid's eating. I just enjoyed, like, you know, everyone I talked to, give me, like, who knows him, give me your best Joel Embiid eating story. You know, whether it's chocolate lava cakes at his pre-draft workout meeting with the Cavaliers, or like Nutella, having a tub of Nutella while he's in high school, things like that. That's kind of funny, more silly. I found, I don't know, my favorite thing interview, like, I mean, it's like my, I was happy. I was proud of my Markelle Fultz chapter in terms of some of the stuff I got in there, trying to unpack some of his backstory and what maybe made his life so difficult while he was in Philadelphia. Some of the stuff about Sixers CEO Scott O'Neill, like, they're not, you know, they're probably not happy with this, but the idea being that how much, how open he was basically about pushing out, trying to go behind Sam Hinkie's back. Like, I have a story about him pitching StubHub to be the Sixers jersey sponsors. In 2015, and I asked StubHub, the guy's name is Scott Cutler, who was the president of StubHub, and I asked him, I got in touch with him, I don't remember why, I saw somewhere that him and O'Neill knew each other, and I asked him, one, so were you worried about sponsoring a team that was so bad? And he said, no, Scott told us that by the time sponsorships are allowed in 2017, the Sixers are going to be good, which stands out because Hinkie didn't believe in setting timelines, right? So that's one. Two, I asked, what did Scott O'Neill say about Sam Hinkie? And he said, I've never heard that name before. I don't know who that is, which I thought pretty surprising given that he was GM of the team then and pretty known, right, in basketball circles. Like, he was not an anonymous GM. By then, the process was a thing. So examples like that are just, you know, just give you, again, just a look behind a curtain of what was actually going on that kind of that informs us in a way of what we end up seeing.
For sure. And we'll get to the Markelle Fultz chapter in a second. I also want to talk about the Brian Colangelo chapter. That's what I mean. You know, you look at this team and this organization, there's just so many characters and so many crazy stories, but we'll get to that in a second. Let's start with the process. So, as I mentioned, Jason Richardson was on the podcast recently, and he was there that first year when Sam Hinkie gets hired. And he kind of talked about how he wasn't a big fan of the the tanking, and early on he was super against it, and he agreed with a lot of the intense reactions from the public where people were hating on it and saying it wasn't the right thing to do. He said, yeah, I was on the team and I agreed with it. I thought that it was the wrong thing. And then over time he got to know Sam and pick his brain and started seeing the kinds of prospects they were bringing in. He talked about seeing Embiid and just how he was blown away. And then he said, okay, I'm a believer. You won, Sam. You know, you won me over. So I thought that was interesting to hear how it kind of, how his perception changed over time. But I really enjoyed in the book, you talk about how not only veteran players, but agents around the league viewed the process. And it's super interesting to hear those kind of conversations. I don't want to give up too much away, but what were some of the stories or things that you heard from either veterans or agents about the process and just kind of the way they viewed it?
I mean, I found it fascinating just how, I mean, again, from the outside, you kind of know this, like, oh, they weren't happy, and you get it. One of the, their job is to protect the players. They didn't think it was a good situation from a player development standpoint. Also looking out for themselves, right? One of the 30 teams who's willing to pay players. Has removed itself from the marketplace, and agents make their money off commissions, right? And that's, you're hurting their bottom line, right? You're going at their wallets. Why would they not fight back? Even with things like the move, you know, circumventing the salary floor by trading for like JaVale McGee, so you have his salary on your books, even though you only have him for a day, so the money doesn't go to the players. Like, there's a lot of stuff they did, which it was taking advantage of the loopholes, but it's, you can understand why that would anger agents. So what I learned is, again, how, like, the ways that that manifests itself. So, you know, after Sam Hinkie trades Michael Carter Williams, someone told me that Jeff Schwartz proclaims the agent, you know, XL Sports, one of the biggest agencies in the league, proclaims we will no longer. They were upset that they hadn't heard from Hinkie beforehand, or they felt that Hinkie had lied to them about whether Michael Carter Williams would be traded. They proclaim, you know, we will not, no play, no, nobody from here is to deal with Sam Hinkie or the Sixers anymore until Hinkie's there. Right? That's a huge thing. I'm from a big agency. So things like that, how that could affect what was how the feelings can turn into real tangible things that can affect your ability to build a team, right? That's what I found interesting.
For sure, yeah. It makes a lot of sense. I mean, if they're not spending their money, and not only that, but they were playing certain guys. I talked to some of the agents who had players that were on those Sixers teams, and even if you had a guy in that team that was putting up big numbers, there was no guarantee that they'd hit the market and get paid either, because there was this doubt of, oh, well, just because they're doing it in Philly doesn't mean that translates to success elsewhere or translates to winning. So it kind of was a lose-lose for those agents. You know, you obviously couldn't get your guys on that team because they're not spending money, but if your guy happened to get drafted there or traded there, you know, he's not really helping his stock either, because people are all discrediting, or, you know, executives around the league are discrediting any kind of statistical success or anything with the Sixers or production. So, yeah, it was really interesting to kind of hear that breakdown. And, you know, like you said, the whole Excel thing where they said they're not going to do business with the Sixers, that was really interesting. Everyone I talked to, though, whether it was Jay Rich or Rashawn Holmes or Jahlil Okafor, they've all said that those teams didn't really let the losing get to them much, that because there were no expectations, there really wasn't much disappointment. Most of those guys were so young, too. They were just happy to kind of be in the NBA and live their dream. What did you learn about the mood and atmosphere of those trust the process teams? Because it seemed like the atmosphere is pretty good, but then you also had some stories in the book that were really interesting about Nerlens Noel, Michael Carter Williams, Jahlil Okafor, some of these guys butting heads and having some issues. So it seems like there was no expectation, so the losing wasn't getting on guys, but some of the personalities, maybe lack of leadership, was affecting things in terms of the mood and atmosphere around the team.
Yeah, I think there'd be people who say the fact that the losing wasn't getting to them at points was a problem, right? There's a story. It was in Brian Colangelo's first year after Jared Bayless and Gerald Henderson were brought in. And after a close home loss, Henderson, they're coming back to the locker room, and Henderson hears some of the young Sixers players laughing. And he yells, "What could possibly be so funny?" And I'm sure there were some expletives added there, right? And Brett Brown kind of heard it and let it go. He wasn't angry. So I think there was a feeling that some of these guys – there was a feeling that losing, like, it would have been okay for the losing to get to them a little bit. It doesn't mean you want to be depressed all the time, but one of the ideas was that, you know, there wasn't, and that comes from veterans, it can be from the coach. I mean, Brett Brown had a really tough job, is you have to keep people upbeat while also have them care, right? And that's a really tough one. But there's another story, like Michael Carter Williams, Brett Brown pulls him from a game and goes, talks to him. I forget what exactly the situation is, but basically Carter Williams points to a scoreboard and basically saying, "We're down by 40, right? Does it matter?" Right? So there are examples like that where the losing you know, lose when people think of how can losing be poisonous, it doesn't just mean in terms of bringing a team down. It can make if you grow numb to the losing, that could be a problem as well, right? So that would be part of my answer there.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think also you talk about this in the book, but Brett Brown wants to be everyone's friend and maybe wasn't the disciplinarian at times that maybe was required for a team like that with a lot of young guys. There were gaps where there weren't many veterans, you know, after Sam Hinkie trades away a bunch of the guys like Drew Holiday and Spencer Hawes and those guys, Thaddeus Young. And after Jason Richardson leaves, there's kind of a gap between that period and then whenever they went out and signed J.J. Redick and Amir Johnson. And that was always my, you know, I was always a believer in the process and the tanking. I felt like the NBA had this loophole and they basically incentivized losing. So you might as well go try to land stars while you can. Now, obviously, it's different, but one of my only complaints about the process, or one of my few complaints, was that there really weren't a lot of veterans on those teams. And I felt like if you wanted to maximize these guys' potential and teach them, the young guys, to be pros, and especially some of these guys in the book, it does a great job of detailing this, but there were certain guys that even people in their life or people during pre-draft were saying, this is someone that will do well, but they need certain guidance or they need certain veterans around them.
Right?
Yeah, Nerlens Noel was someone like that. I think even Mike Carter-Williams was kind of like that too, just because he had made some mistakes before entering the NBA. So there were certain guys that needed that veteran leadership and veteran presence and maybe didn't have it as much as they needed. There were certain guys in the locker room certainly that kind of stepped into those roles, but would you agree that that was kind of the issue, where if the coaching staff isn't being the disciplinarians, maybe that would have fallen on the veterans, but there just weren't enough of those kind of veteran players?
Yeah, so a couple of things here. So what you said, yeah, Noel, like Calipari told me, you know, he's like, we tell all the teams, you know, our guys are good, but here they're 19 years old, we have them on a strict schedule. Like he basically, his way of saying, like, yeah, we tell them, like, you have to keep an eye out, you have to work with them when they get to the league, right? They're kids. And that definitely applied to Noel. I do think with the veterans, it is important to draw a distinction. I'm not saying you do this. It often gets thrown around that if you happen to be in the league for 10 years, you therefore are a good mentor.
Right, that's true.
That's not the case. Right? There's a difference between a guy who's a veteran and a guy who's a leader, right? So just getting some random guy because he's old doesn't necessarily make sense, right? In fact, that can be the opposite. Those guys want to play. There could be issues. Getting an actual guy who can actually mentor younger players, yeah, I think that would have helped. That would have helped Brett. Brown, he was in. So the way I describe it is, yeah, he failed to create a culture of accountability, and that's on him, and it's hurt him. It's hurt the team for the years. It started with Noel. It kind of went through to the Okafor and Embiid and Simmons, and, you know, it's a problem now, and it's probably going to cost him his job in the end, right, or be one of the things that cost him his job. That said, it's not fair to put it all on him. He made some mistakes that wanted to be friends with the guys, were friendly, like he cared about that. But it's just, again, there was no one to help him, whether it was players, whether it was the staff, his assistants. Like, they didn't have any, like, all his assistants were young and mostly new. Hinkie also, some coaches have a kind of a heavy behind them, an executive, the GM. Hinkie was not that. He did not attend practices. He thought it was important to draw a line, build a wall between him and the coaching staff because they had different incentives, right? He recognized that. He didn't think it'd be fair to be around the team so much if they're trying to win, and he basically does not want the team to win. So that kind of left Brown on an island. Also, some of the players, like, he got dealt some tough cards. Guys like Noel, guys like Embiid, who, I don't know, would anybody be willing to be able to sort of get him to change his diet, let's say, things like that? I don't know. And then you throw in the other part is Embiid, his whole rookie year where he had a lot of issues. That all happened after he finds out a month into his rookie season that his brother is tragically killed back in Cameroon. So if that doesn't happen, is he acting differently? Maybe then he's not, you know, drinking Shirley Temples and blowing off cardio sessions and things like that. So there's so many different things swirling around that's not necessarily fair to put it all at Brown's feet. That said, you know, as a coach, you do own some of the blame for that.
Right. That makes sense. One thing that stands out to me about the process, too, you know, we all know the Sixers landed Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons, and that's what everyone talks about. But it also helped the Sixers find some great diamonds in the rough. They were constantly bringing G League players or journeymen or second round picks, guys like that. And then they gave them a ton of playing time to audition them. So, you know, as you mentioned in the book, in Sam Hinkie's first season alone, they had 28 players come and go, which is wild. But they were, by doing that, they were able to find Robert Covington, who was undrafted, TJ McConnell, who was undrafted, Jeremy Grant, who was a second round pick. I feel like that aspect of the process doesn't get talked about enough. Would you agree?
Yeah, though it's funny because they did find those guys. I don't know, it's funny. I don't know what the rate is supposed to be. You know, they missed out a lot of guys too, because obviously you bring that many in. Like, I don't know what the rate would be, like what we would consider a good rate. You know, how many guys you have to hit on versus how many come out. Because there are people who say, okay, what do they have to show for all those random guys they brought in? McConnell, Covington, and Grant, and that's it. It's a fair point, right? And that one of the criticisms, or I guess one of the things I'm most fascinated, I don't know if this fully answers your question. Hey, it would have been interesting to see what happened. The teardown's easy, and even drafting, it's not easy, but like, you're taking a lot of picks, you can hit on a few guys. It's when you have to start making bets on players, you know, the guys you want to go to war with, the guys who you think can be playoff players, the guys who you think can't, who you have to trade, things like that. That's hard, and it would have been fascinating to see what Hinkie would have looked like then. And I think that's where some traditional scouting things might come into play more a little bit. Like, can you stay in front of your man on the ball, right? Can you create a shot in the playoffs? Things like that. And it would have been really interesting to see if that, what that would have looked like had Hinkie been allowed to stay and be in the fold there.
Yeah, I do wonder, had Hinkie been able to finish this out, you know, what moves he would have made going forward, how he would have pivoted from kind of the rebuild. We kind of saw it a bit toward the end, but he was still kind of hoarding draft picks and focusing on getting as many swings. So it would be interesting to see what he did as a contending, or as a GM of a contending team. But one other thing that you write about is the fact that not only were they bringing in top prospects, they were also focusing on bringing in new technology, improving the player development staff. Picking the players was only part of it. They also wanted to make sure that they had the right people in place to maximize those players' potential. You write about how they were using wearable technology to grade players in games and practices, but also track their heart rate and sleep throughout the day, even at home when they were sleeping. Now, quite a few teams are doing things like that, or something similar at least, but it seems like the Sixers are one of the first teams to implement that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, and they definitely, like, that was one of their focuses, was the idea of build up the infrastructure, not just from a roster standpoint, right? From everything. Like, what I found great, that they had this whole team of guys who would basically track, and I guess you could do this now, like NBA.com probably has this, or Synergy, I don't know, but basically track all sorts of things, like how quickly you ran back after misses and loose ball dives and a bunch of other stuff. And they would give team, they would give every player a grade the day after a game. And like, Tony Roden told me a great story that he came in and like, it goes, you know, he scored like 30 points or whatever, his career high, and he thinks he's great, and he sees his grade as a D. And it's like, why? It's because he didn't box guys out, and he didn't hustle back here, and he didn't push the ball. And I forget some other examples and more complicated stuff. I'm giving those aren't great examples I'm giving, but more interesting and complicated stuff that they felt, you know, that at least you could control. That was one of the things they felt you can control, and to help develop and build the system and the style of play that they wanted, so that was in place by the time, so that when the talent came around, the system and style was already there.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think if you look at any team that has not only done well in the draft, but then had developed their own prospects, like the Oklahoma City Thunder, for example, with Kevin Durant, Russell Westbrook, James Harden, Serge Ibaka, not only were they great at drafting, but they had these great development plans and coaches in place so that these guys could maximize their potential. So that's definitely a huge part of it. It was just interesting to see that side of the process, because you don't hear a lot about that. It's mostly talked about, you know, the draft picks. I want to talk about Joel Embiid's background. You kind of alluded to this at the beginning of our conversation, but you write about how he had it pretty rough after he moved to the United States. It's hard to believe now, obviously, but he was really shy, didn't have any friends. He was so raw, so he struggled a lot on the court early on, even though it was clear that he had a ton of potential and had the athleticism and physical frame to be very effective in the future. He really wasn't that great. He couldn't dribble, couldn't catch the ball. He really struggled a lot early on. You also mentioned he lost his brother really early in his NBA career, which was a really hard time for him. What did you learn when you were researching Embiid's background from, you know, his high school days to his early NBA career?
A lot, right? I found, you know, we all think because he's funny on Instagram that he's this outgoing guy, and he's not. He changed a little bit, but he's an introvert, really. And I guess, again, it shouldn't be such a surprise, like being outgoing on social media. I think we know enough of this just from knowing people we know. Does not mean you are outgoing in person, right? There's very different things. So there's that part. The part about his backstory, I mean, I found interesting. There are people, and I'm not saying it's right, but they're like an uncle and a former coach and a former agent. Like, there are people in his life who feel like he sort of has written them out of his story, right? When he tells his story to Players Tribune or other sites, who feel like they've been left out of the picture, and they're hurt by that. Like, his uncle told me he's hurt by that. His uncle, the story, you know, story's been told different ways, but the way my understanding is, the way Embiid was discovered was, you know, his uncle emailed a scout. His uncle knew basketball. His uncle knew he had a tall nephew. Sent the scout he knew a picture of Joel standing in front of a doorpost wearing a Kobe jersey to show how tall he was. Standing in front of a doorpost was to show how tall he was. So a scout saying, "It's my nephew. He's tall. He plays volleyball. Do you think he could play?" The scout was interested, came and kind of met Embiid's parents in Cameroon and pitched them on the idea of Embiid going over to the States to play high school basketball to try to get a scholarship and rise through there. So there's things like that. His evolution from shy, so again, as I'm saying, he's shy and an introvert, he's still changed a little bit. So his evolution from shy and quiet and being overwhelmed by everything in America, which, I mean, obviously, like, it'd be strange if he wasn't like that. You come in your age 15, 16 to a different country without your family, that's crazy, right? The evolution from that to where he starts like shimmying a little bit and during games and dunking on guys and pushing back at opponent at teammates and practices and things like that. I found that interesting too. So there's a bunch just little nuggets that could sort of show who he actually is. Like, there's more to him than the funny Instagram captions.
For sure. And I'm sure part of it too was getting that confidence. It's tough whenever you move here, you don't really speak great English, and you're getting kind of teased and you stand out because you're 7 feet tall. And then all of a sudden, when you start dominating on the court and feeling good about yourself, I'm sure that kind of changed his demeanor and how he acted a little bit. But yeah, it was interesting. I think everyone now, especially people maybe who aren't Sixers fans or didn't follow his career earlier on, they just see him as this superstar who is super funny and extroverted. And it was interesting to kind of hear his backstory. I want to finish with this on Sam Hinkie, then we'll get to some of the other chapters here. But looking back, you know, obviously Sam Hinkie gets fired. He has the letter, or resigns, I suppose, but he's kind of being forced out. He resigns, has the letter, kind of got mocked when he put the letter out there. But what are some things that maybe Hinkie should have done differently? If you look back at his tenure, whether it was specific decisions he made, the Kristaps Porzingis decision kind of stands out. You have a chapter about that in the book. Whether it's specific decisions or ways that he handled certain things or certain situations, what are some things that you think Hinkie would maybe do differently if he could do this all over again?
Okay, so what would he do differently? What do I think he should do? Because those are two separate things, right?
Good point. What do you think he should have done differently?
I think he should have recognized the political, how political the NBA is and how small world it is. And it doesn't mean change a lot. Like, you don't have to kowtow to agents. Just, you don't have to give in every time, right? And Hinkie's belief was, okay, so Jeff Schwartz doesn't like me now, but in 2 years when we're really good, if he has a star player and that player wants to come with us, is he going to say, no, you can't because they didn't give me enough notice on Michael Carter-Williams trade, right? And that's fair. He was probably right about that. So it doesn't mean on like everything. And but it doesn't mean sometimes you can take the L, right? Little times it's okay to not even take the L, to just not crush him and just build up some goodwill so the relationships are still there. And not only that, to help play the narrative, I think that part he missed on. And it doesn't mean like he gets criticized for not talking to the media, and I think that's often misplaced. A lot of GMs and presidents, and maybe this is different even the past 5-6 years, you know, and Hinkie's been gone, but a lot of GMs and presidents don't do many on-the-record conversations, right? Just the new NBA. I think if you have that, if I told you that now, that doesn't stand out so much. Like, the Knicks just hired a president of basketball operations and he didn't even do a press conference, right? And I know the Knicks aren't the best example, but they're pretty. Sam Presti, everyone loves Sam Presti. He hasn't talked to the press really ever. So you have examples of that, but I do think, and Hinkie would talk to reporters a lot in background, but I do think just being open to the idea that making that building a narrative to support you will help you sell your vision, and by doing that help you keep your job, and how that's important. That's one. The other thing I would say is I'm always surprised he didn't surround himself with more people with different viewpoints, and that's one of the things he's always preached, the idea. It's like a Silicon Valley thing, right? You want to, and it makes sense, you want to surround yourself and have different viewpoints, different perspectives in the room. And yet when it came down to it, you know, the main executives, the main room was him, Sachin Gupta, who's a former Rockets guy, he's with the Timberwolves, really smart guy, very good guy. Ben Falk, same thing. You know, people know him as a creator of Cleaning the Glass, right? Those are the two main deputies under Hinkie. All really smart people, all really good people. But they all come at the game from a similar perspective, analytically inclined, which is great. Didn't play at, I'm going to say a high level, didn't really play at any level above high school, if even that, right? And like the example I always give is I think he would have benefited from having an Elton Brand type as an assistant GM, just in the room with him, just giving a different perspective, also giving him, you know, working as outreach with agents in the league and stuff like that. So that's one of the things I think he should have done differently.
Yeah, that's interesting. I like that take. So a few more things here. Markelle Fultz, the name of the chapter is "This is not the effing kid we drafted," and it was interesting, kind of.
That's a quote.
yeah, for sure, exactly. I do want to. Yeah, good point. I'm glad you put that out there. It was super interesting. I mean, the Fultz story itself is just one of the craziest things we've seen in the NBA in recent years, where a guy goes number one, and experts are saying he's going to be a superstar, and comparing him to these, you know, great point guards, and then all of a sudden has an injury, kind of can't shoot the ball. There's all these different things kind of come up. What did you learn while doing the research and interviews for the Markelle Fultz aspect of this book?
That there was a lot going on in his life that I'm always wary of drawing, well, this happened because of that, because I don't know, right? And the Fultz stuff is always tough to discuss because him and his agent have made very clear that they refuse to entertain the notion that anything happened here other than a shoulder injury. And anytime you go into, so if you disagree with that and you're going into, you're saying it's a Yips-like thing and that's, you know, leads you down a mental health path, and that's always tricky and dangerous to discuss. So I'm just always wary. I'm not even saying from like looking out from covering my own ass type of perspective. Just, I don't know, right? But I do find it was interesting learning about a lot of the stresses going on in his life while he was in Philadelphia. After he had just been drafted, leading up to his rookie year. So things like, you know, moving to Cherry Hill and his mom and his best friend, who was serving as manager, sort of disagreeing, and little things like the mom wanting to blame the manager and the friend. And so they found out, neighbors found out he liked Chick-fil-A, and were leaving food or sandwiches on his doorstep in his Cherry Hill house. The mom had asked the friend / manager to make out flyers to give them to neighbors saying, "Leave us alone." She didn't like how he handed out the flyers, ended up telling Markelle, "You have to choose between the two of us." Markelle didn't look at that as a choice, so he, you know, the friend kind of left the picture. The story where Markelle runs out the house when I crying, saying, "The money did this to us. I wish I stayed in college." Things like that, all these stresses in his life going on that, again, we don't know, and I don't think people, even the Sixers, don't know what exactly happened there. But some of the details of that, some of the details about how baffled the Sixers were, you know, Brett Brown going to Fultz's trainer, coach, saying, you know, "What's going on here?" You know, they were recognized because Fultz was shooting in the training facility that summer. "What's going on here?" And the coach saying, "We're going to work it out." So there was a ton of, I'll call it, stuff going on that I think helps paint a picture of what happened.
For sure. That situation's crazy. And then you go to another crazy situation, the Brian Colangelo burner accounts. It was really interesting to kind of see how it all got reported. In the chapter, you kind of open with the writer who got the DM that was kind of tipped off about it and how it all kind of came to light. And it's just crazy to me. That's still so surreal that it actually happened. Not only that someone was using burner accounts, but the way that he was using them by criticizing players and media and all these different things and defending his callers and crazy things like that. You know, what are some, I know you talked to Jerry Colangelo too. You actually went on a radio show last year and talked about that as well, a Philly radio show. What are some of the things that you learned about that situation? You know, obviously everyone should read the chapter and read the entire book. I mean, it's a fantastic book, but what are some things you found out about the Colangelo situation that interested you?
He's putting it all together and trying to synthesize all that stuff into coherent paragraphs and sentences and pages and a chapter. It was just crazy, right? It was so ridiculous. You're like, looking, what am I doing here? So I found it illuminating a few things. One, it just, look, when you have that and you look back, and Brian Colangelo was very clearly somebody who cared a lot about what people think, and just looking back at him and, you know, finding quotes from 1990 articles about him in Phoenix and him talking about how he's aware of the nepotism charge, that he's only there because of Jerry's son, and how that bothers him. And you realize that, and then he ends up in a situation in Philadelphia where he's following in the footsteps or replacing a guy who had been ousted that a lot of fans loved and kind of was like a cult-like following. And you look back, you're like, oh my God, this is an awful situation for somebody like that, somebody who cares so much about what people think. And I mean, I don't say that as a, like, it sounds like a criticism. I mean, I care what people think, so I get it, right? And then not only that, he's working for Jerry, his father, again. So it was just combustible, I guess would be the word, right? So you have that, and we see that play out in the Burnergate stuff. So you have that part. You have, I just found it fascinating. Not fascinating. I don't know. That guy's story that he heard, like, you know, Brian was in touch with the Ringer about. I mean, in a way, he knew they were looking at the Twitter accounts, and yet he was still scouting. And so there are stories around the league about him. There was a pre-draft workout the day, I don't remember for who, but I think it was in LA, the day the story went live, and like people there could see him scrolling on his phone. You know, the Ringer had that green background, that very noticeable green background, and people could see him reading, you know, reading the Ringer story and then walking out of the gym. Just, I don't know. I don't make anything of that.
Yeah.
Just an amazing detail, right? I don't know why he was there if he knew this was coming down the pipeline. So yeah, I don't know. What was your even question? Like, what I find most, I don't remember what your question was. I just found the whole thing illuminating. I guess it was a sad, ugly and sad ending, but something that I'll say, not that that was predictable, but that, you know, in hindsight, looking back at what we know about Brian and the situation he walked into, not that that was predictable, but just it probably should have been obvious this would not end well.
Yeah, no, great way of putting it. It was really interesting. And I remember just sitting there thinking, did we just see an NBA general manager lose his job because of tweets? I mean, it was crazy. And I just remember that situation as it was kind of unfolding, just being in such shock. But the way that you kind of report it in the book, too, is super fascinating. Last question for you. I don't think we'll ever see a tank quite as all out or obvious as the process again, in large part because the NBA doesn't want that and made sure to change the draft lottery odds so that there's less incentive to tank. Would you agree that we'll never see another tank quite like the process?
I would bet against it. Yeah. One, like lottery odds changed it to super. You know, one of the things was that the idea was that was the best way to get superstars, or really the only way was to draft them. Now, again, it still helps, but contracts are shorter. Superstars or stars come on the market more frequently and in different ways. It's more also more like football almost, right? Like that with the shorter contracts. So yeah, I think the math between those two things, it makes the math almost, the math doesn't really work out. And then the league, you know, understanding that this was not something they like. So I'm not going to say never. And we'll see teams tank for 1 or 2 years. But, you know, Hinkie was ready to go into year 4 at least. I don't know if we'll ever see that again.
For sure. Thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate you joining me to talk about all this. I know things are crazy right now. So thanks for taking time out of your day to break down your awesome book. It was a pleasure to read. I really enjoyed it. And it was great talking to you, too.
You too, man. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Make sure you all check out Tanking to the Top, which is available now. We have a link in the description. So if you guys want to order the book, go right to the description and you can just go right to Amazon and order it right there. It is a fantastic read, as I mentioned, and there's nothing else to do right now. So might as well sit down and read it unless you have kids. Sorry. if you have kids, you know, go ahead, get their homeschooling done and then sit down and read it. Make sure you check it out. And if you guys want to hear more episodes of the Hoopsite podcast, check us out on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, anywhere your favorite podcasts are found. And until next time, thanks for listening.